Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, on the heels of the United Nations Annual Conference on the Status of Women, we explore some of the realities of human trafficking, modern-day slavery, and exploitation. This year's conference focused on ending violence against women at a time when modern slavery has become a more than $35 billion industry that enslaves millions of people, mostly, but not exclusively, women and girls. The State Department estimated that in 2012, 27 million people were being held as slaves, mostly as sex slaves, and many held in Western nations. Just last week, a UK commission found more than 1,000 cases of enslavement. Most were women and girls forced into sexual exploitation. What are the realities of trafficking and slavery in 2013? We're joined by three experts. Kathleen Kim is professor of law at Loyola Law School, and she currently co-directs the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance and Support Team. Her publications include The Coercion of Trafficked Workers and Reconceptualizing Approaches to Human Trafficking. Siddharth Kara is a fellow at the Carr Center Program on Human Trafficking and Modern Slavery. He's the author of the award-winning book Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, and Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia. Kara also advises the United Nations, the U.S. government, and several others on anti-slavery research policy. Jillian Wiley is also with us. She's a professor in international peace studies and the author of many publications, including Human Trafficking in Europe, Character, Causes, and Consequences, and Defining Trafficking, Denying Justice, Forced Labor in Ireland, and the Consequences of Trafficking Discourse. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for being with us. Siddharth Kara, let's start with you. You've interviewed people who have been trafficked, and you've looked at this problem from an international scope. Let's start with how somebody ends up in trafficking and what their situation is.
Well, in fact, I've probably spent the better part of the last 13 years documenting personally more than 1,300 cases of human trafficking and modern-day slavery directly. In the course of all of those cases, if there are any broad trends of the typical scenario or case that one finds with human trafficking, it would be something like this. On one side of the equation, you have someone who's in a very vulnerable situation. It could be because of poverty, female gender, minority caste status, they live in a military conflict zone, anything that's rendering them quite vulnerable or desperate. And on the other side of the equation, you've got demand for cheap or virtually unpaid labor. And in between those two, you've got the trafficker or exploiter who sort of bridges that gap between vulnerability and exploitation. In very broad strokes, that's really what I've seen. Men, women, and children, highly vulnerable, highly susceptible, and even when they're aware of the risks, so desperate that they were willing to accept offers for work and then are exploited due to their vulnerability to generate immense profits for their exploiters.
Now, you opened one of your books with the story of a family who sold their daughter, but they were really tricked into the sale. Is this typical, and how does this manifest itself?
Well, again, you will certainly find any number of scenarios whereby trafficking victims are acquired, and deceit or fraud is probably the most commonly used tactic. And it could be a fraudulent job offer, a fraudulent offer to send a child to a school or to a work opportunity with the promise of some sort of a wage. And then once that child is in the hands of the trafficker, of course, the reality sets in, and the child or the adult could be exploited for months or years in exceedingly bleak and barbaric and brutish circumstances. Some families might send a child out of sheer desperation and destitution, knowing what's in store for them, and some might be absolutely tricked. And they're, of course, more susceptible to that trickery because of the fact that they're in such vulnerable circumstances and such desperate circumstances.
Kathleen Kim, let's bring you in. You were a lawyer before a law professor, so you have also witnessed this from a perspective. What would you add?
I specialized in filing civil lawsuits against traffickers, and I started this work early in the 2000s, right after the Trafficking Victims Protection Act had been passed, the chief federal law addressing human trafficking in the United States. And it was an opportunity for advocates to hopefully obtain immigration relief for trafficked workers and therefore eliminate the fear of deportation that traffic workers might face if they were to hold their traffickers directly accountable in civil court proceedings. After implementing this project, because it was brand new, there were many clients that began to come out of the woodwork. I went into different communities. I went to massage parlors. I went to workers' rights centers, day labor centers, domestic worker centers, to do Know Your Rights presentations. And soon enough, traffic workers started coming to the surface through word of mouth, Good Samaritans who may have identified trafficking cases and assisted traffic workers to be liberated, also connected those individuals to me, and then other social service organizations that encountered traffic workers were able to connect those workers to me. And I saw a vast array of different types of trafficking cases. Of course, the prototypical sex trafficking cases, maybe women providing sexual services in massage parlors, but also everything you can imagine in every kind of labor sector, hotel workers from Ukraine, taqueria workers from Mexico, domestic workers in working in private homes from the Philippines, construction workers, garment workers from Thailand. So it was very eye-opening. And, of course, the workers were experiencing very substandard working conditions, but the hallmark of trafficking or forced labor, as I saw it in the United States, was that these workers felt like they couldn't leave the work situation through a vast range of threats and intimidation that they were experiencing from their trafficker that did not always include overt, direct physical restraint, but more often than not included threats and coercion involving subtle psychological intimidation.
So you primarily worked with trafficking victims that were in the United States.
Yes, these are foreign traffic workers brought to the United States or foreign traffic workers who may have voluntarily migrated to the United States, but then were subsequently recruited to work in situations that became forced labor situations.
And it sounds like the use of fear was what kept them in their circumstances. And what would you say is the hallmark of their circumstances?
Very substandard working conditions, very egregious working conditions, little to no pay, although many traffic workers are paid, but all of the cases that I dealt with, very minimal pay. And in addition to that, a loss of freedom of mobility. The workers were subject to ridiculous rules and restrictions on the kinds of contact they could have with the outside world. They were told that if they were to tell anyone about their working conditions, then the traffickers would retaliate by calling law enforcement on them, because many of these workers had no immigration status or their immigration status was somehow connected to their trafficker. The workers also experience very specific cultural threats. For example, a client from Kenya had received a threat from her trafficker that related to some very specific cultural threats related to her tribe regarding where she should be buried and what might happen to her in her afterlife if she were not buried in her homeland, those kinds of things. So the kinds of threats that these workers experience range from what you might typically hear of fear, threats of deportation, but also specific cultural threats that place them in a psychological cage.
Siddharth Khara, you described a different set of situations predominantly outside of the United States, even though you did look at the U.S. as well, in terms of how the traffickers keep people in the trafficking business as sex slaves in particular. What were some of the methods that you saw?
Well, I think what my fellow panelists have described is certainly the case domestically and internationally in many cases. Of course, threats against the individual or their family members are a very common tactic used, and there are sociocultural threats or tactics or forces as well. But, of course, you may also have out-and-out imprisonment, restriction of liberty, severe restriction of liberty. People will be physically constrained. One young girl might be tortured or even killed and made an example of to show the fate that would happened to other girls. I'm thinking of a brothel I went to in India in this case. In West Africa, mutilation and other tactics were used. I met one woman at a shelter whose arm had been chopped off, and she was used as an example to the other girls, what would happen to them if they tried to escape. So the tactics can be very brutish, it can be very barbaric, and they can be, as well, things that are less direct, like a threat against a child or a family member, a threat of deportation, and other things that make a person feel they have little to no choice but to do what they're told, as terrible as that might be.
And Jillian Wiley, you focus on Europe. How would you say the European situation compares?
Well, I think we do see cases of sex trafficking and labor trafficking, some of which would tally with some of the things that Kathleen in particular was talking about in the labor situation of substandard working conditions and people being exploited and kicked through various coercive means. However, I think important to add into this discussion is some of the complexity that exists between vulnerable people and the existence of, say, distance of demand for their labour. And I would be particularly concerned in my work to be looking at the ways in which political systems of migration restriction and work permit systems and visa systems and so on all play into creating situations of difficulty for migrant workers. For instance, looking at the way in which in the European context we've seen the closure of the possibility of migration into Europe. We sometimes talk about fortress Europe over here, the difficulty that people have in migrating for work into Europe because of visa restrictions, particularly from the third countries of the global south. And so I would want to direct attention to those kind of policies that governments create, which I think are part of the problem that leads to human trafficking, but also smuggling and other forms of undocumented and irregular migration. I would want to add that layer of political complexity to the story of the trafficking problem.
All right, well, that's a perfect bridge. Let's go right into that, about some of the systemic and structural issues that enable this to continue. Kathleen Kim, what would you add to that?
I completely agree with Ms. Wiley that in the United States, migration restrictions are a chief factor in facilitating trafficking. There are very few legal avenues for safe migration into the United States, yet the demand for cheap labor is constant and present, and the desire of migrants to come to the United States in search of better opportunities is also constant and present. Because of these immigration restrictions, then workers do have to resort to very risky means of migration and risky situations, risky work situations that end up becoming forced labor situations. We have an undocumented population of approximately 11 million individuals, over 8 million of which are undocumented workers, which make up 5% of our domestic workforce. These are individuals that may be experiencing some level of inherent coercion in the workplace because of their lack of status. Because of their lack of status, even if an employer doesn't directly intimidate them for the threat of deportation, these workers are often chilled from asserting labor rights, asserting workers' rights, and objecting to substandard working condition because of the fear that their undocumented status may be discovered if they do bring accountability to their working conditions, they do bring to light their substandard working conditions. So that's a serious problem. We also have a temporary worker program in the United States, which ties workers to their employers so that they don't have job portability. Our guest worker program, in particular the H-2 worker, H-2A workers, H-2B workers, these are the agricultural workers, these are the low-skill temporary workers, and we have found trafficking rampant in these guest worker programs. The Signal case involving a class of over 500 Indian workers that were brought to work in the Deep South in the United States for a construction company, Signal International, subjected to egregious working conditions, subjected to trafficking. These were all HTB workers, as an example of that.
Siddharth Kara, you look more specifically in sex trafficking. How does that compare? Are they the same structures and systems?
I think by and large, across the spectrum of human trafficking cases, whether it's for commercial sex or labor exploitation, and oftentimes one individual may find themselves being exploited in both contexts. I think by and large, what my colleagues have described really is quite on point. There's a huge legal and policy confusion vis-a-vis smuggling and human trafficking and migration domestically in the United States and around the world. And the lack of clarity and the confusion on this issue is very important for one fundamental reason. The policy responses of a state to smuggling or human trafficking are very different. If someone is deemed to be in violation of migration policy, they tend to be deported. And what happens is it can be very difficult to identify someone who has smuggled themselves or been smuggled into a country or has been trafficked. Oftentimes, someone will migrate willingly or be smuggled into a country and at some future point be put into forced labor conditions. But we tend to see these people as offenders first, offenders of migration policy or labor policy or prostitution laws, and victims second, if at all. And this results in their deportation. It results in you not being able to bring a claim typically against their exploiters and traffickers, and it perpetuates the cycle of exploitation of the vulnerable. So the policies on migration, the confusion in this whole arena of migration and smuggling and trafficking, the net of all of that is more exploitation and suffering of the vulnerable by and large.
Let's move back to you, Gillian Wiley. Ireland in particular is trying to address some of these issues. You've written about that. Do you find that the new approaches might be helpful? I understand they're looking at things from a perspective of demand as well. How are they approaching this, and do you find it to be adequate?
Yeah, well, in the Irish context, since 2008, we've had a law that parallels international law on human trafficking, and the government has been responding by setting up a human trafficking unit in the Department of Justice that consults with civil society and is developing a national action plan, and is trying to collect data and statistics on the extent of trafficking in Ireland. So there's quite a strong response from the Irish state. As you say, there's also a strong lobby coming from civil society for addressing demand, in particular in relation to the sex industry. And in the European context, very often there's the advocacy of a model in Sweden where demand for sexual services is criminalised, and there's quite a strong lobby in Ireland for the adoption of that, but equally there's a strong concern about that model, about whether it in fact creates more harm than good for women working in the sex industry, and whether it has the sort of public education and effects that the Swedish government claims that it does. So it's still being fought out in civil society in Ireland at the moment whether addressing demands in the sex industry in particular is helpful in terms of tackling trafficking. My own inclinations are that it's not, because it conflates prostitution and trafficking, that the two things are the same, whereas there are many women working in the sex industry who do not consider themselves coerced, so I have my doubts around that, and I haven't seen convincing empirical evidence that the model being used in Sweden is working. So I'm skeptical about the demands for getting rid of demand, if you see what I mean, in the Irish context. So it's a very live issue here, though. The government is looking into the future of prostitution policy in Ireland at the moment and hasn't come to a conclusion yet, but it's under consideration.
Well, Siddharth Kara, let's bring you back in for a moment about the issue of women being trafficked into prostitution and what that relationship is, given these new models that are trying to be enacted in various countries and the experiments that are being done. Because you specifically focused on sex slavery in your book, what would you say the relationship is in these situations of legalized or illegal prostitution?
Well, I think this is a very important question, and it's a very challenging question to get clear answers on. Now, across six continents, I've looked very specifically into this issue, including in Europe, Asia, all over the world. And you have two possible extreme or poles in the response. One is to legalize prostitution, bring it out into the open, and try to put into place protections, monitoring, that will hopefully eliminate anyone being actually exploited, minors being exploited, or people being coerced, right? That's the theory. And on the other side, you have what the previous panelists described, a country like Sweden, or perhaps Norway does, which is to criminalize the purchase, criminalize demand, with the idea that this will dry up the market of people wanting to purchase commercial sex, and then, of course, there's no need to traffic them or exploit them or coerce them because there's no market for the purchase of commercial sex. She's right to say there isn't real persuasive hard data that answers this question conclusively, but in my experience, from what I've seen around the world, what tends to happen is this. Where you provide a legalization regime, it is very difficult to actually effectively monitor. And what happens is, oftentimes, you create a legal veneer behind which exploitation can take place. And it can be very easy to torture or threaten or beat someone into saying that they're doing something by choice. And after that point, it is very difficult to establish that that's not the case. It's not to say that a legalization regime couldn't be done effectively. I haven't seen it done effectively yet. What I have seen is that oftentimes there's an influx of foreign women who are suddenly in red light areas, saying that they're all there by choice. And when you dig a little deeper, you find that that may not necessarily be the case. So I get a little nervous about legalization regimes, only based on what I've seen across the last 12 or 13 years around the world. I would also point out to one study that was done here in the Boston area on demand specifically, looking at men who purchase commercial sex on a regular basis. And if they were presented with a scenario that they perceived a tangible increase in risk or cost, either fines or risk like shaming them or outing them to their family. If they perceived a tangible increase in a risk or cost associated with that behavior, more than 90% said they would either curtail or cessate altogether the purchase of commercial sex. Now, that has to be tested in the real world, but at least it's some indication, and this is a pretty good study, some indication of what kinds of policies might be effective vis-a-vis sex trafficking.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the realities of human trafficking, modern-day slavery, and exploitation. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're talking about the realities of human trafficking, modern-day slavery, and exploitation. About the movement of vulnerable people, particularly women and girls, into places like the United States or Europe, whether it's into a legal or an illegal situation, at the point of moving them, don't their options change?
There's a couple of things we have to bear in mind. The first is, someone who's trafficked for sexual exploitation may be trafficked within their own country. They don't necessarily have to cross an international border, right? So we should make sure, I mean, there are plenty of people within the United States who are trafficked, American young girls trafficked into prostitution, plenty of people around the world who are trafficked internally. And theoretically, they don't necessarily have the exact same extremities of circumstances that other trafficking victims might. For example, they would know the local language. They may have some sense of how to access resources or assistance. Now, they're often very vulnerable, very young, and very threatened, and it doesn't work out that way. But when they're crossing an international border, you're absolutely right. Things get very difficult very quickly. They may not know the local language. If they're told the police are going to detain you and beat you, why would they doubt that? If they're told any number of things by their trafficker, and particular kept in isolation, kept from forming ties, it can be very difficult and very intimidating, especially for a young person, to have any sense of where is my avenue to assistance. And oftentimes, as I said, they will be shown through example what will happen to them if they test the limits in any way, if they try to communicate, if they make a call on a cell phone, if they break any sort of rules, they'll be shown very quickly what will happen to them, and it's almost invariably something very terrible.
Kathleen Kim, let's go back to you now and talk about some of the legal problems that you see in curtailing these trafficking and slavery problems that we are facing in the 21st century.
My expertise is in the U.S. with the U.S. domestic legal framework, and the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, the chief federal law addressing human trafficking, is derived from the 13th Amendment, which, of course, abolished slavery in 1865. And so from a theoretical point of view, the Trafficking Act aims to prevent unfree labor, a form of unfree labor that follows a lineage of unfree labor beginning with chattel slavery, which the 13th Amendment abolished. What the Trafficking Act does is provide a framework that was originally called a 3P framework, prosecuting traffickers, protecting victims through services and immigration relief, and prevention of trafficking, largely through education efforts and sanctioning efforts for overseas to countries who might not be complying with anti-trafficking standards. However, so in theory, all of this is good, but the way that it's deployed in practice is often different from the theoretical framework. And in practice, what we've seen is a predominantly criminal enforcement approach that tends to criminalize what our other panelists have identified as being victims. So a criminal enforcement approach that may criminalize individuals who are actually victims of human trafficking. And the previous discussion regarding sex trafficking and prostitution, I think, highlights this phenomenon. So the way I see the debate between legalization of prostitution versus increased criminalization detracts us from what is actually happening on the ground, which is less relevant to whether prostitution is legalized or kept illegal, but rather how law enforcement continues to criminalize individuals who may actually be victims of human trafficking. And this definitely occurs in the context of sex trafficking, when law enforcement may see individuals as consensual prostitutes and thereby precluding the notion that there may be a non-compliant sex worker within one situation of commercial sex. Or in another kind of trafficking context, law enforcement may see an individual as a criminal migrant who was willingly, voluntarily smuggled across the border rather than a victim of trafficking in a labor situation.
Jillian Wiley, let's bring you back in and talk about the other inadequacies that you have found in the legal framework.
Yeah, well, just picking up on the last comment there, I think we have found that the implementation of law hasn't produced very many cases that have made their way through the courts to successful prosecution, very few in fact. And that leads me to concur with the previous panelists that when trafficking becomes kind of tightly defined around coercion, deception, movement, and exploitation. It gets very hard for victims to be identified, for cases to be built across jurisdictions, and for successful prosecutions to happen. And since, I think in 2004, the European Group of Experts on Trafficking were suggesting that we really need to be most concerned with the exploitation. So less concerned with the issue of, was the person smuggled, was the person trafficked, are they an undocumented migrant, but what is the exploitative experience that they have in the place where they're working. And that, for me, is a central question. However, I think for governments, particularly governments concerned about borders and migration, they tend to emphasise the other end of the story. How did the person move? Did they move voluntarily? How did they enter the state? Rather than worrying or putting the emphasis on the question of exploitation. And I think really important to make sure that in all the kind of sectors where undocumented migrants work, where people might be trafficked or smuggled, are good labour regulation, ability to access the labour market through migration and visas and permits, good organisation within these labour sectors, decent conditions and so on, are all very much at the core of addressing the problem of exploitation in the global labour market rather than the concern of governments, which tends to be around minding their borders.
Siddharth Khara, let's go back to you. What do you think is missing in terms of trying to understand this very complex issue?
You know, there's any number of ways to answer that question, but I genuinely think that the quality that is fundamentally missing in the response to this issue all over the world is something called compassion. The issue needs to be analyzed more effectively. We need more data. We need to test policies and all of that. But I think if we take a step back and realize that something simple as compassion will guide us into what kind of policies would be most effective to safely empower a victim of human trafficking, what kinds of policies and resources need to be deployed in order to protect not just the victim, but punish the offender. And I think all of this is driven by compassion. And I think right now the approach is very much a criminal law approach, a border approach, an us and them approach, as opposed to we collectively, we as a planet. People have been exploited in slave-like conditions and outright servitude for the preponderance of human history. And for the preponderance of human history, you could actually do that legally. You could legally own someone. Now, that may not be the case today, but people are still exploited in conditions like that. And we have to ask ourselves that this day and age, with all our advancements in human rights and a sense of equality across gender, across class, across age, across caste, why is it the case that we are so ill-equipped and ineffective at adequately protecting and empowering vulnerable children, vulnerable women, vulnerable migrants? And I think, frankly, it comes down to an issue of genuine compassion.
Given the long look back at history, are we making progress from your assessment?
No, I genuinely think we've made progress as a human civilization on many fronts, right? We determined quite unanimously in the 19th century that legally owning and enslaving another person is unacceptable. That was a major point of progress that did not come easily. But having said that, there are still millions, if not tens of millions of people who are exploited in conditions like that. So the aspiration of the advancement of human rights that we did achieve across the centuries remains largely unfulfilled. And I think the next step in progress we need to make is finding a way in the contemporary global context, and in particular the context of a global economy where supply and demand meet all over the world. In this context, how do we make the next steps of progress in protecting individuals from servitude? And I think that's where we're coming up very short.
Kathleen Kim?
I would completely agree with those statements that in the United States, it's still very difficult for victims of human trafficking to obtain the relief and services that are legally provided to them by the trafficking statute. And I do believe that's because of a predominantly criminal enforcement approach, an objective to prosecute traffickers. Therefore, protection of victims becomes secondary. There are also certain obstacles in the threshold for obtaining immigration relief, because the standard by which immigration relief is adjudicated is often arbitrarily deployed, and the standard is often very high, and becomes difficult for victims to establish that they are entitled to that relief.
Jillian Wiley.
Yeah, well, I think there is a problem in that the predominant response has been criminalization and kind of securitization of borders type response to the issues. And there's a huge contradiction there in the fact that we live in a globalized world where money and goods flow freely, but people are very constrained in their global movement. So I think, as well as compassion, we need a rights-based response to migration and migrant workers.
That's a perfect place to end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Kathleen Kim is professor of law at Loyola Law School and co-directs the Anti-Trafficking Litigation Assistance and Support Team. Siddharth Kara is a fellow at the Kara Center Program on Human Trafficking and Modern Slavery at Harvard University and the author of Sex Trafficking Inside the Business of Modern Slavery and Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia. Jillian Wiley is a professor in International Peace Studies and the author of publications such as Human Trafficking in Europe, Character, Causes, and Consequences. When we come back, what is the relationship of human trafficking and slavery to prostitution? Stay tuned.
Don't you all know? Don't you all care? Don't you all see how this is unfair? Are we all blind? Do we not see? Do we not bend to misery? Of course we all know. Of course we all care. Of course we all see how this is unfair. We
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. While human trafficking and slavery affect all walks of life, women and girls make up 80% of the estimated 800,000 people trafficked across national borders annually, with 79% of them trafficked for sexual exploitation. How does prostitution play into this? We have three experts with us now. Kathleen Berry is with us. She is Professor Emeritus at Penn State University and the author of Female Sexual Slavery and Making War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Catherine McKinnon is professor of law at University of Michigan Law School and the author of Sex Equality, Only Words, Women's Lives, Men's Laws, and Are Women Human? Melissa Farley is also with us. She is a clinical psychologist, an associate scholar with the Center for World Indigenous Studies, and a consultant with governments and NGOs for issues related to trafficked women. She's also the author of Men Who Buy Sex, Who They Buy, and What They Know. Welcome to the three of you. I'd like to start with a sense of the scope of trafficking today. The State Department estimates now 27 million people held as slaves. That was in 2012. The industry, I understand, is something like $35 billion industry. What is the scope today? Are these accurate numbers? Do they depict what we are facing in 2013?
I think it's very difficult to know. And the difficulty begins with the definition of the problem. Whether you're trying to separate trafficking from prostitution itself, it really cannot be done. There's a basic problem with definition of what it is. The other problem is that it's never possible to get really good statistics on illegal underground activity, but they're more likely understated. When you put the whole industry together, and not separate trafficking from prostitution and consider the extent of it globally, it's a phenomenal problem of really mammoth proportions.
We did a study in Nevada looking at legal and illegal prostitution, and a number that we came up with in 2007 to quantify the size of the trafficking problem. In my estimation, like many other statistics on violence against women in the U.S. and elsewhere, that's woefully low. We talked to law enforcement sources, investigative reporters, and mafia-controlled taxi drivers, and I asked them all the same question. How much does the sex industry generate in Las Vegas alone a year? And what they said, all of these sources, was between $1 and $5 billion a year. So that's one city, which suggests to me that saying $35 billion in the entire world is a little low. Department of Health and Human Services has just reported that trafficking victims are located not only in street and brothel prostitution, but also in pornography, stripping, massage parlors, spas, video cam sex shows, prostitution tourism, and servile marriages, or mail order brides, which is what pimps call them.
How does the legalization of things such as prostitution affect trafficking? Countries that are legalizing prostitution, or in our case, in Nevada. Catherine McKinnon?
When prostitution is legalized, all the studies show, both those by governments and those by non-governmental organizations, that both trafficking in general and illegal prostitution in addition to that go through the roof. And it's easy to understand why. The traffickers realize that all they have to do is get the women and children, mainly, into the place where it's legal, and they've got a free ride from then on. And, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving, because, you know, unlike drugs and guns, you can sell the person again and again and again and continue to profit from their abuse. So there's trafficking escalates astronomically, and this is extremely well documented, under legalization as a regime. What you have are illegal brothels springing up. This is especially well documented in Australia, where there's been a lot of attention to the problem, which is why it's well documented there, springing up right next to the legal brothels. And the reason for that is that one is that the women who are finding themselves in a situation of prostitution typically think that that isn't all their life is going to be. And in order to, there's something they have to be doing right now, perhaps, and this is for the people who aren't 100% in captivity but have been coerced by economic forces, by racism, by sexism, all those social forces that are what, and age, get people into prostitution, always actually destitution. So they've been coerced in that way. They are thinking they have to do this now, but don't want this to be, they have dreams, they have ideas about what their life is going to be later. This isn't all their life is going to be. So they don't want to be in the legal brothels, because to do that, you have to have a real name. It becomes part of your official history, your medical records, which, if there's any benefits at all to legalization, it is that they provide medical care, which in some instances is dubious, but you can start to see that, you know, it becomes an official part of your life history. So they don't want that. Secondly, the men don't want to go to the legal brothels because, at least many of them don't, because what happens, again, if there is any benefit to legalization, it includes a reduction of the abusive sex, or supposed reduction of the abusive sex acts that happen inside the brothels. So in order to attempt to do this, what they do is the man walks in and they get rid of his belt, his shoelaces, his tie, his cigarette lighter. I am now listing sex toys for those who blessedly aren't educated in this vocabulary. And also, when you get into the room, there are no pillows, because, as one pimp so articulately put it, it's a murder weapon. There aren't telephones with lines on them. All of these things are removed, and what that clearly means and communicates is that the men can't have the sex the way they want to have it. They can't do the things they're there to do. And believe me, they're there to do what they want to do. So that means that those who are willing to pay a little bit more and also to have sex without condoms, which of course can make one sick and can be deadly, condoms are often required, or at least they say they are, in the legal brothels, but not in the illegal ones. So those who are willing to pay more for the vastly more dangerous sex in the illegal brothels go next door. Pay a little bit more for the women who have even fewer choices than the women in the legal brothels, and but are trying to keep their futures open. So that's just a brief snapshot of what happens under legalization, despite the purported good intentions of people who support it.
How does the trafficking actually occur generally? I understand there are a lot of circumstances, especially for young women or girls, who tend to be either runaways or in very dire situations where they've been abused at home that end up going into these situations where they're abused again. But is there a common pattern among the people who are trafficked?
The problem is not just trafficking. It is not just a severe form of enslavement. Some have been trafficked by pimps. Some have been trafficked by gangs. Some have come out of being abused by their fathers or their brothers or their uncles and hitting the streets because they've run away from unbearable conditions and find that there's nothing that a young girl can do on the street to survive and end up in prostitution. Are they any less victims than the victims of who are actually trafficked? And so we have to look at the whole thing.
There's still this underground process. What is the underground system? How does it work?
The traffickers and pimps have infinite versatility in procuring women and girls. If you find that there's no employment market for large numbers of women in the Philippines, then you locate in the Philippines. You promise women jobs in Germany or the Netherlands, where it's legal, it's easy to get them in. And when they get there, they find out they're in prostitution. Others operate through finding, they're very, very keen in their ability to pick out vulnerability in young girls, especially runaways. It's almost like written on their faces on the streets. And so pimps are very effective in identifying them and promising to take care of them, providing them a meal, getting them to wherever they are staying, and then forcing them to turn a trick. And once they've done that, it's hard to get out of their clutches. And so wherever there's, the important thing is that wherever there's a population of buyers, wherever there's consumer demand, pimps and traffickers will ploy on whatever available population of women there is, whether it's women migrating from poorer countries than the one that we live in, and looking for a better standard of living, looking for work abroad, and being defrauded. All of those practices are part of what goes on with that.
What all of us know, in a country in which, I'm talking about the U.S. now, the number of families living on $2 or less per person per day for at least a month has doubled in the last 15 years, and the safety net is disappearing for women with abusive partners. We're seeing women who prostitute for cheeseburgers or for gas money. You can't just look at trafficking as a problem of sexual violence or sexual behavior. You have to look at poverty and racism as well. It's a triple cage for women. It's a form of sexual violence that generates huge profits, unlike rape and battering and incest. Irish survivor said to me the other day that the only difference between is that a woman prostituted through poverty or destitution or the fear of those things, she can never say, I was forced. She can never say that because the world won't accept it, and then she has to deal with much more shame.
Let's look at the legal aspects of this. And Catherine MacKinnon, let's look at how international law addresses trafficking, slavery, prostitution. How does it distinguish between them? Does it distinguish? Should it not distinguish? And how do the distinctions manifest themselves in reality?
You know, international law doesn't actually make the distinction between prostitution and trafficking that a lot of people are attempting to push these days. It hasn't made it since 1949. Much of the history, the earliest history of international law, of countries coming together to create an international legal system, has occurred in connection with attempts to stop a trade in women. So, you know, the way it is now, we have a legal system that internationally recognizes that if there is third-party involvement, you have that thing called trafficking, and that it is done for purposes of prostitution, overwhelmingly, although it's also done for other purposes, often which are intimately interconnected with prostitution. For example, sometimes people are trafficked. You mentioned the situation in the UK at this point. There are some important cases going on there as well as research and notice on the question. And what you notice is sometimes people are trafficked for forms, things that actually are work, human sexuality not being work. They're trafficked for activities that are work, including to be owned and used by private people. And then it is not uncommon for them to be sexually abused. Or if they should escape that, what are they then supposed to do? What are their options? Often they wind up, you know, in prostitution anyway. So were they trafficked according to the narrow definition? Well, it wasn't force, fraud, and coercion that got them into the UK. However, by the narrow definitions that are used not only by the State Department but by the Justice Department in the United States, but it is forms of force that have got them into this situation. And why do they wind up there? The real answer is they have no real options. You know, their desire to leave is also made vividly clear in Melissa Farley's excellent research. It's both very simple and in some ways complicated, because particularly when prostituted people are made criminals, a lot of them then have a criminal record. And so what are they then supposed to do? When they go to try to get a job, typically they're asked, do you have a criminal record? If they say yes, they don't get hired. If they say no, they can be fired at any moment.
So have there been any remedies or models that have been successful?
Well, yes, there have been. And the Swedish model or the Nordic model is currently being extremely successful. They focus on the buyers, strongly criminalize them, enforce that law so that the people being arrested for prostitution are those who are the reasons why it exists, the money machine, the people who are constantly, I mean, the reason, quite honestly, there are pimps and traffickers is not because there's bad people in the world. It's because there's a tremendous amount of money to be made doing it. And the reason that money is to be made is not because of the pimps and traffickers. It's because of the buyers. They are the source of the money. So what Sweden first did in 1999-2000 was to pass a law that strongly criminalized the buyers while not criminalizing in any way or making illegal in any way the people who are being prostituted, and providing some amount, although not yet sufficient, amount of support and job training for jobs they say they want. Educational support, economic support, and so on, for women who want to leave. exit, it is called. And this has reduced prostitution in Sweden to the degree it is able to be analyzed by about 85%. Trafficking has essentially disappeared from Sweden for economic reasons that are easy to understand, which is, why traffic women into Sweden where your customers are criminals when you can traffic them everywhere else, like to the Netherlands or Germany, where, you know, it's the whole thing is legal.
So in terms of criminalizing the buyers, here in the U.S., if we looked at slavery, whether it is sexual slavery or domestic servitude slavery, that's also criminalized, but it's still going on underground. Kathleen Berry?
If you dry up the market, there's no business for the traffickers. And
except for the slavery that is done in private. We've had slaves on this show before and people talking about slavery before and how incredibly prevalent it is still today that people are getting trafficked into slavery. This is something that I'm not sure if it gets addressed by the same remedy, but there may be.
You know, it's a bit like peeling back the onion in the sense that you get closer to the core of the problem the more you move in and remove parts of it. And the more you peel back those layers, the closer you get to the actual conditions of what you're calling the most kind of classic forms of slavery. All of it can be made public. Condition. We know that when women are trafficked for domestic service, that they're sexually exploited and abused. Now, that's really private slavery, because they're domestics in a household. But those cases break open. The traffickers get found. And as long as we have an angle on getting into these issues, just a matter of getting these laws more and more adopted and enacted, we're leaving less and less room for what you're calling this very classical privatized slavery.
So let me thank the three of you, Melissa Farley, Catherine McKinnon, and Kathleen Berry. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Berry is Professor Emeritus at Penn State University and the author of Female Sexual Slavery and Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Catherine McKinnon is Professor of Law at University of Michigan Law School and the author of Sex Equality, Only Words, Women's Lives, Men's Laws, and Are Women Human? Melissa Farley is a clinical psychologist, an associate scholar with the Center for World Indigenous Studies, and a consultant with governments and NGOs for issues related to trafficked women. She's also the author of Men Who Buy Sex, Who They Buy, and What They Know. That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Akhasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at Armudian. We'll see you next week.
Hey,